This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Bush has repeatedly appealed to the Iraqi people to view the invasion that may be just a few hours away now as the first step in the creation of a peaceful, free, and democratic nation. But Iraq is a mosaic of ethnic, religious, and cultural groups, some of which harbor long-held resentments. Iraq's Kurds, Sunnis, and Shia are in many ways distinct communities who may view each other with suspicion as soon as a U.S.-led attack undermines the authority of Saddam Hussein's ruthless regime. There are smaller groups, Turkmen, Armenians, Christians, and others, and while the majority of Iraq's population is urban, relatively well-educated, and modernized, tribes and clans are also important elements of this complex society. Many observers believe that judging the loyalties and balancing the interests of all of these groups will be a critical part of the war to come and the peace to follow. If you have questions about the different peoples of Iraq, or if you spent time among them, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Perhaps the most immediate problem is in northern Iraq, which is dominated by the Kurds, a separate ethnic and linguistic group that has ruled a largely autonomous zone of its own under the protection of Allied aircraft since the end of the Gulf War 12 years ago. Most Kurds despise Saddam Hussein, and many are eager to return to their homes in the cities of Mosul and Kirkuk, homes they lost in Saddam's program to Arabize these important oil cities. Joining us now from Kurdish-controlled Takya in northern Iraq is NPR's Ivan Watson. And Ivan, I know it's late there. Appreciate you staying up to talk with us.
No problem.
The Kurds, as we mentioned, many of them want to see an end to Saddam Hussein's rule. What is the mood right now amongst the Kurds you've been speaking with?
Well, I'm here very close to the front lines where the Iraqi army is stationed, about 5 miles away. And here, the entire countryside, the towns and villages here, have been virtually evacuated. Families have been streaming out of here for the past several days. And now in the town of Chanchamal, which is just about 2 minutes' drive from here, all you can see basically are men in the street, most of them armed. And that sense of fear that we had as people were packing their tractors and trucks and taxis and buses to get out of here, to go for the safety of the hills, that has diminished some. And now among these men, there's a sense of anticipation, of excitement. They're waiting for the American attack to start so that they can, some of them want to participate. Many of them are looking forward to crossing these front lines, to see some of these lands that many of them have been kicked out of by Saddam Hussein's regime. And there's great hope that this may finally be the end of the Baghdad regime that they have warred against, that they have fought against for so many years.
As we've mentioned, many Kurds hope to return to the Iraqi-controlled city of Kirkuk, an important oil city. That is something the United States has expressed concern about. And what is the danger if that does happen?
Well, right. Washington has told the Kurds, you are not to go into Kirkuk, as well as Kirkuk, another major northern city, Mosul. Both are viewed as traditional Kurdish homelands. The Kurdish leaders say, we are following Washington's instructions, we have no plans to move anywhere. But if you talk to rank and file fighters and officers, some of them have been forcibly expelled from this city over the past decade or two, and many of them are very excited about going back, and some will even openly say that as soon as the Americans begin bombing, we will move in. So it's a big question of what can happen, because Turkey, neighboring Turkey, which has very tense relations with the Turks, they've indicated that this is a red line. If the Kurds go for Kirkuk, which is perhaps the biggest oil city, an economic prize if the Kurds could ever seize it, and it could help them achieve some aspiration for an independent statehood. If they go for Kirkuk, the Turks have said that this is cause for war.
The Turks would presumably say that this is a situation that's kind of out of control, and they would need to go in there to preserve order or something like that?
They have said that if the Kurds go for this city, that it would give them the wherewithal to create their own state. There are also competing claims to Kirkuk. The Turkmen people, who are Turkic-speaking It's a Turkic-speaking community here. They also claim Kirkuk as a traditional homeland. Turkmen populations have also been deported forcibly from Kirkuk, and they're also claiming this place. And the Turkmens that are now living in northern Iraq, some of them have very tense relations with the Kurds. They've come to blows. There are accusations of terrorism against each other's groups. And the Turks have said that if any Turkmens are oppressed or persecuted by the Kurds, if they are blocked from their traditional right to reoccupy Kirkuk, that this will also be a reason to go to war to protect their Turkish-speaking brothers.
Would you think that the United States would be very interested in getting some U.S. forces to Kirkuk very early in any conflict to try to control this situation? Is that a possibility?
I think it is a possibility, but the confusion perhaps over whether or not the U.S. could open a northern front from Turkey has thrown some of those plans up in the air, it seems. Remember, the U.S. was planning to station some 60,000 troops within neighboring Turkey, and in theory, those troops could have swept down, taking the major cities, taking Kirkuk, securing it. Now it's not clear whether they could land enough forces here in the north to do it without this kind of land bridge. There's some speculation that maybe they could seek to use the Kurds, who have tens of thousands of armed fighters, perhaps, to actually use them in the offensive. This is just speculation, of course. We have no idea what exactly will happen. Here on the ground in northern Iraq, there have just been a few sightings of American soldiers, special forces types, perhaps CIA agents. We have not seen large numbers of troops landing here. There have been many wild rumors over the past several days as people get very excited now, especially with people fleeing their homes right now. But it's just not clear what exactly the plan will be. Again, speaking to some of the Kurdish fighters on the ground, I'm being hosted by a Kurdish commander right now. He said, as soon as the Americans attack, I'm going home. He says he hasn't been home in nearly 20 years since he was expelled by Saddam Hussein.
We talk about the Kurds as if they were a single entity, yet this is a divided community as well.
Absolutely. The Kurds themselves, there are two main factions or political parties that each have their own armies, and they fought civil wars against each other throughout the 90s. They are still serious rivals. There's a lot of distrust and suspicion between the two groups. They have said they have come together, they have united, they're trying to present a united front in the face of this coming war and to better negotiate with both the Americans and the Turks and to have a say in the future of Iraq. However, there is deep distrust between these groups, and there are other armed factions within northern Iraq as well. There are the Turkmens, who have very tense relations with one of the main Kurdish factions. There are Islamist Kurds called Ansar al-Islam that are holed up in a series of hills along the Iranian border. They've been fighting a virtual mini civil war with the Kurds for the better part of a year. So this is not a unified body up here.
And yet more Kurds who are still loyal to Saddam Hussein, or at least were yesterday.
I'm sorry?
And some Kurds who are still loyal to Saddam Hussein, no?
There has been a tradition of what have been called Jash. They're Kurds who were bought or loyal to Saddam Hussein. There was a report of a major defection of one Kurdish leader who had been a longtime supporter of Saddam Hussein. There are also reports of, or we're hearing from Kurdish intelligence officials, that perhaps there could be some move for an uprising. We have to remember that in 1991, following the Gulf War, the Kurds, as well as the Shias in the south, they rose up and they were actually able to take control of Kirkuk for a short period, as well as some other cities. They did control parts of northern Iraq. Now, that rebellion was pretty quickly crushed by Saddam Hussein's forces, both in the south, where the Shias revolted, and here in the north. And people bitterly remember the results of that uprising, though you have many, many supporters of the U.S. here in Kurdish northern Iraq. There is also a lingering memory of how they believe the Americans did not come to their aid when Saddam Hussein's helicopters came in and crushed this revolt, that the American army, which had just kicked the Iraqi army out of Kuwait, stood by and watched the Kurdish revolt be destroyed.
Thanks very much, Ivan. Get some sleep. You may need it.
Thank you very much.
NPR's Ivan Watson speaking with us from northern Iraq. Joining us now by phone from his office in Cooksville, Tennessee, is Michael Gunter. He's professor of political science at Tennessee Technological University, the author of The Kurdish Predicament in Iraq, a Political Analysis. And good of you to speak with us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to what Ivan Watson had to say. What do you think the immediate effect of a coalition invasion would have in the northern Iraq area on the Kurds?
Well, look, in speculating about the future, we must confess uncertainty. Joseph Biden, U.S. Senator, just recently said the Americans have no notion of what we're about to undertake, and I think that goes for the Kurds, too. We just have so many variables in play here. But I think certainly the Kurds are right now hoping for the end of Saddam's terror and the continuing threat of Saddam. The Kurds hope for a democratic, parliamentary, and federal Iraq in a post-Saddam Iraq that will allow them to exercise their political and cultural rights as a people and as individuals. And maybe even more, that this will be accepted by their neighbors, especially Turkey and Iran and, of course, the United States, because the United States has a mixed track record here. The United States has protected the Kurds more than other outside powers, but the United States has also betrayed the Kurds several times. In 1975, in 1991, right after the Gulf War, and there are signs that the United States might seek to invite Turkey in right now and to quash any type of autonomy on the part of the Iraqi Kurds. So the Iraqi Kurds have a very doubtful future right now and are certainly afraid that they may lose their de facto independence that they've held since 1991.
We should say, Professor, that the Iraqi parliament is expected to vote tomorrow to allow U.S. aircraft to use Turkish airspace. As of earlier today, Ari Fleischer, the White House press secretary, said the United States does not wish Turkish forces to cross the border and go into northern Iraq, and has made that clear to the Turkish government.
Right. I think you mean the Turkish parliament will...
Yes, that's what I meant.
Meet. Turkey has been one of the most loyal American allies for over half a century, supported us very strongly in the Korean War, even.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we have serious problems with Turkey. There's no way of glossing over the fact that the United States would have preferred a strong northern front against Iraq, and this was only possible if Turkey allowed American troops and their equipment into Turkey to strike Iraq from the north. And as you know, as you just mentioned, Turkey has held off from doing this. And in so doing, Turkey has probably shot itself in its foot, because if Turkey had let the American troops into Turkey, the Turks could have entered northern Iraq with an American agreement and also received a great deal of American financial aid, which the Turks greatly need. But Turkey is a democracy, and the people in Turkey are heavily against letting an American army in, and the Turkish parliament has been very hesitant to allow even, as you say, the American airplanes maybe will be allowed to fly over Turkey, but this is not the type of northern front that we were hoping for.
We're talking about the ethnic and religious groups in Iraq and their roles in country post-Saddam. We're taking your questions and comments at 800-989-TALK, or you can email us at totn@npr.org. When we come back from the break, more from Michael Gunter on the Kurds. We'll also talk about two other dominant groups in Iraq, the Shia and the Sunnis. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about whether ethnic and religious differences in Iraq might complicate efforts to stabilize the country during and after a conflict. Our guest is Michael Gunter, author of The Kurdish Predicament in Iraq, a Political Analysis. You're invited to join our discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And why don't we go right to the phones? Our first caller is Ben, who's on the line with us from Riverside, California.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I just want to make a comment on the situation that the United States keep arming Iraqi Kurds. I think this is a big mistake that in the future the whole region might be put in a chaos. And also, I think Turkey has a concern of the situation, and I think they have a right to be concerned, because arming Iraqi Kurds also put Turkey in a big danger.
Well, Professor Gunter, isn't that closing the barn door after the horses left? The Kurds are armed.
Yes, I agree with Ben.
They are armed. I think they are armed, and they've been trained by CIA.
Yes, so let's get a response from Professor Gunter.
I agree with Ben that Turkey has a legitimate interest in this situation. Turkey should not have unreasonable fears of the Iraqi Kurds. The Iraqi Kurds have gone out of their way to assure Turkey that the Iraqi Kurds are not going to instigate a revolt of the Kurds in Turkey, that the Iraqi Kurds are going to remain within a parliamentary, democratic, federal Iraq. And as you said, Neil, the Iraqi Kurds were not armed by the United States. The Iraqi Kurds have been armed for years. The Iraqi Kurds have been fighting their battles against the Iraqi state since the 1920s, ever since Iraq was created. If the United States did not exist, I can assure you that the Iraqi Kurds would still be fighting on one level or another. Now, it's true the United States has protected the Iraqi Kurds since the end of the Gulf War with the no-fly zone, but that no-fly zone has also been facilitated by Turkey, which houses the no-fly zone. So Turkey has been supporting the Iraqi Kurds, too.
Ben, thanks very much.
Sure.
Let's go now to Neil, who's on the line from Los Angeles. Hello? I think Neil has left us, but thanks for the call anyway. Let's try Lev, and Lev is on the line from Tahoe City, California.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment and a question. Number one, I'm an ex-Vietnam vet and an Armenian, and I think the Turkish would have a lot more problems than just the Kurds, considering the genocide of the Turkish Ottoman Empire. But my question is, considering the population of not only Kurds, but Christian Armenians as well in Iraq, will not the presence of Turkish troops disrupt the region even further?
As far as the Armenian genocide and massacres in World War I, there are two sides to that question, as you well know, and that could be debated forever. Now, your question had to do about Turkish troops disrupting the situation in northern Iraq?
Well, yeah. I mean, neither the Kurds want the Turks there, nor the Christian Armenians.
Well, that's certainly true, but Turkey, as a neighboring great power, is very concerned about the destabilization on its border, and it has every legitimate right to be, much as the United States would be concerned if there were some danger in Mexico, right on the Texas border. The U.S. would have a legitimate interest in that. And so I think Turkey has a legitimate interest in what is going on in northern Iraq, but it should not be a paranoid interest based on conspiracy theories and so forth. Right now, you have a very mild form of Iraqi Kurdish nationalism that I think would be willing to cooperate with Turkey in such a way that Turkey would not be endangered.
Michael Gunter, as you mentioned, the Kurds under the no-fly zone were able to establish a largely autonomous area of their own. Has that led to resentment that they've gotten preferential treatment from other people inside Iraq, from the Shia, who've not had there's been a no-fly zone in the south too, but they've not had the same kind of protection?
There probably has been some, but frankly, the Shia have received more support, the little that it has been with this no-fly zone in the south, than they ever received before. And I think that
the Iraqi Kurds in the past 10 years have put the lie to the claim that Muslims are unable to have a democracy and that Iraqis cannot have a democracy. The Iraqi Kurds, largely on themselves, albeit with American no-fly zone protection, the Iraqi Kurds have built a thriving civil society and parliamentary democracy against all possible odds, which I think is an example for the rest of Iraq. And the Iraqi opposition groups meeting in London in just this past December specifically recognized that the Iraqi Kurdish model is a model for all of Iraq to follow in the post-Saddam Iraq. So I would say no, that the other Iraqi groups, most of them are very in favor of what has gone on with the Kurds and hope that they can expand this to the rest of Iraq.
Michael Gunter, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Michael Gunter is the author of The Kurdish Predicament in Iraq, a political analysis. He teaches politics at the Tennessee Technological University in Cooksville, Tennessee. Joining us now is Adid Dawisha, an Iraqi-born political scientist who teaches at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. He's the author of Arab Nationalism in the 20th Century, From Triumph to Despair, and he's with us from the studios of WMUB, and good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for inviting me.
As we talk about some of the other large groups in Iraq, can you describe for us the difference between the Shia and the Sunni Muslims?
The difference isn't that great, since both of them are in fact Arabs, and both of them have over the last 70 years of Iraqi sovereign existence claimed loyalty to the state. There is a sectarian difference, and that goes back to the early days of Islam as a religion. When the Prophet died, he did not subscribe any procedural rules for succession, and so two groups emerged. One of them kind of advocated the election, so to speak, of people from within the Muslim community, of a person who would be the successor to the Prophet. The other group actually advocated the succession of the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law, Ali, and this was a smaller group, and these are the ones that are called Shia, from the word Shi'at Ali, which means the party of Ali. From then on, throughout the history of Islam, the group that wanted Ali as the successor, the Shia, have always traditionally been the smaller group, and by definition, therefore, the persecuted group by the majority Sunni population. What we have now in the Muslim world is about maybe 80-85% of Muslims being Sunnis, but there is a high concentration of Shiites in the region of the world in which Iraq finds itself. Iran has a majority of Shiites. Iraq has a majority of Shiites, and one or two countries in the Gulf, smaller ones, have a majority of Shiites. So. That's the difference between the two. But in terms of Iraq, the differences between the Shiites and the Sunnis, I think, has been somewhat exaggerated.
During the Iran-Iraq war, as you mentioned, Iran is a great majority of them are Shiites. They thought the Shia Arabs in Iraq might rally to their side. It didn't turn out that way.
And this was done at the height of the charismatic leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini. And he used the radio to really good effect by appealing time and time and time again to the Shiites to separate from Iraq, and indeed to the Shiite soldiers to defect. Remember that Iraq's army, at least the rank and file of Iraq's army, 80% of that rank and file is Shiite. And throughout the 8 years of the Iraq-Iran war, there was hardly any indication of defections by Arab Shiite soldiers from the Iraqi army, even when prodded on by Ayatollah Khomeini himself.
Some observers are concerned that the Shia community might see an invasion, the undermining of the Saddam Hussein regime, as an opportunity to strike out at Sunnis, maybe not on a sectarian basis, but on the basis of the fact that the Sunnis have been the elite in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, and this would be an opportunity to get back at them retribution.
Let me say two things about that. First of all, there is this kind of myth that goes is repeated time and time again here, that somehow the Sunnis are in the pocket of Saddam Hussein, that generally speaking, Saddam Hussein depends on the Sunnis for his support. The truth is that the Sunni community has been touched as much as as the other communities in Iraq by the malevolence and by the brutality of Saddam Hussein and his henchmen. They are as much aggrieved by the by Saddam's regime as the rest. The Shiites have, and I think quite legitimately, have demanded a redistribution of political power in their favor. After all, they do constitute about 60 to 65% of the Iraqi population, and they have every right to demand a proportionate amount of political power, which, as you rightly say, has so far been dominated by members of the Sunni community. But I must admit, I have not heard anything beyond these demands, which to my mind are legitimate. And therefore, I also would think that that this kind of possibility of Shiites taking vengeance on innocent Sunnis just because they happen to be Sunnis and Saddam Hussein happens to be Sunni, I also find that somewhat exaggerated.
Let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Kevin, who's on the line with us from Fall River, Massachusetts.
Yes, your guest seems to be downplaying the differences between the Sunni and Shia. But, I mean, why is there a no-fly zone? Why was there a revolt that was, I guess, in the beginning very successful and then put down very ferociously, and we have a necessity for a fly zone? Is it just a matter of Hussein, or is there really a basis of that revolt being derived from you know, the differences between the two communities? It goes beyond just Hussein's rule. And also, why, and also the more important second part of the question is Saudi Arabia and some of the other Sunni Arab countries. It appears that they're not indifferent to who rules in Iraq. And since, you know, the Saudi Arabians are, and some of those other Arab Gulf states are up supplying bases and are supposedly our allies, you know, would they be in favor of a democracy that would, you know, with the Shia being constituting 65% of the population, would it be a, you know, a sectarian group that would be something not akin to what the Sunnis in the Gulf states would prefer?
Adi Dawisha?
Yeah, well, the answer to the first question is the no-fly zone in the South was because, as a result of the Gulf War and the entry of American troops into Iraq from the South, and in a sense establishing a bridgehead in the south, in the southern part of Iraq, that that precipitated a revolt by the people who live in the south of Iraq, who happen to be Shiites, of course. But in a sense, given the because of the kind of the strength that they felt with the Americans being in there, and the defeat of the Iraqi army at the hand of the Americans in the south, and its retreat to Baghdad, it literally cleared the area from Saddam and his henchmen. That allowed the revolt to take place. Once we decided that we were not going to help this revolt, and we took our forces out, it was Saddam Hussein who then and his military who then went back to the south and exacted their vengeance on the people in the south. As a result of that, we felt the only way we can protect them is by instituting a no-fly zone. Had the American forces in 1991 moved towards Baghdad, then maybe we'd have seen the fly zone extended to there. So it was just a matter of historical strategic development that the South rebelled, that the South was left on its own, and that therefore Saddam Hussein took vengeance on it, which necessitated the no-fly zone. As for the Gulf states and the fact that they were Sunnis and might be worried about Shiite ascendancy in Iraq, I certainly would share this concern personally and as perceived by the Gulf state and the Saudis if the Shiites come to power through non-legitimate means. If they become the ruling group through, say, some kind of a military coup, and if they established the kind of authoritarian regimes that we have become accustomed to in the Middle East, that would be worrying. Mm-hmm. But if they come or at least if their share of power increases as a result of a federal democratic system, I think as democracies we know in the world, they tend to be generally less aggressive and less irredentist than dictatorships. And I think that in itself, in and of itself, will probably mean that that the kind of aggression that people worry about if the Shiites come, the Shiites came to power, will not come to pass.
Kevin, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about the divisions within Iraq with Professor Adid Dawisha, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Can you talk to us for a minute about the importance of tribes and clans in Iraq?
The Iraq, in fact, what is interesting about the country is that it is a highly urbanized society. Something like 80-85% of the peoples of Iraq, in fact, live in settled communities and in cities. However, there is no doubt that many of these people who live in urban in the urban parts of Iraq do have tribal identities. Iraq, say, in the late 19th century, was dominated by the countryside rather than by the cities. And as a result of that, there is a kind of a sense of tribal and clannish identities. What is interesting about this is that from about the 1940s, 50s onward, and certainly during the initial years of the Ba'athist regime under Saddam Hussein, say throughout the 1970s and certainly up to the late 1980s, this tribal identity was dormant. In fact, it was denigrated. It was seen as something that was retrogressive, regressive, reactionary. All the Ba'athist propaganda, all the speeches of Saddam Hussein talked about tribalism and clanism as something of the past, that Iraq with its modern outlook, with its outlook towards the future should not abide by. However, what has happened in the last 10 years is you see a shift by Saddam Hussein himself and his propaganda machine towards tribalism. He now extols tribal virtues. He goes to tribal domains. He dances with them. He shoots guns in the air in the same kind of exuberant celebrations that tribes usually have. He also, along with that, has tried to resurrect religious identity much more. There has been a move by him as the middle class has become debilitated by sanctions, and certainly because of his conflict with the West, and the middle class usually, as a class, tends to look to the West for inspiration. As a result of that, he has moved back into tribal and religious concerns, and that has indeed increased tribalism and clannish identity, as well as religious identity in Iraq over the last decade or so.
We're talking about the different divisions within Iraq with Professor Adid Dawisha. We'll come back with another question for him after our break. We'll also be joined by General Thomas Rain, retired, who's a military consultant to NPR and who commanded the 1st Infantry Division during the Gulf War, to talk about the military significance of these divisions in the conflict that may begin soon. Your questions, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. We'll be back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As you know, President Bush's ultimatum to Saddam Hussein expires tonight at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Stay tuned to NPR News for the latest, later tonight, on All Things Considered. Still with us is Professor Adid Dawisha of the University of Miami at Ohio. And let's go to another caller. And John joins us on the line from Princeton, New Jersey.
I believe that the Kurds in the peace conferences after the First World War were promised by the Western powers their own nation. This was 1920 to 22. There were a series of conferences.
I think it was the Treaty of Sèvres.
That's right.
And it seems to me, this is a somewhat provocative thought, but all our good allies, long-term allies in the area, have actually turned out to be not allies, Saudi Arabia and Turkey being two of them. when push comes to shove, they have not supported us. And it seems to me that we know that the Kurds are surrounded by the Iranians, the Turks, the Syrians, all of whom have traditionally put them down and will continue to do so. That the Kurds have no friends except the U.S. And if the U.S. was to make a deal with the Kurds, either as part of a federated Iraq or as an independent entity, the U.S. would guarantee them security in return for bases. I don't think we would ever have trouble getting access to and using those bases because the Kurds know they have nowhere to turn to. In fact, basically, the Kurds feel they can't trust anybody, quite rightly so, because history has proved it. Even the Americans have betrayed them. But it seems to me that this issue is never going to be solved until the Kurds get their own nation. Everyone seems to be enamored of this concept that we have to keep boundaries the way they are. But it's going to be an ongoing problem for hundreds of years if the Kurds don't get their own, at least, autonomy within Iraq. Mm-hmm. And preferably their own homeland. I know that's unrealistic because it would mean taking land from all the neighbors.
From Iran and Turkey as well as from, and probably
and Syria.
Syria too, yes.
And Syria. But, I mean, this issue is not going to be settled, and the Kurds are not going to go away unless you allow a pogrom and a massacre like what the Turks did to the Armenians. And I don't think anyone is going to allow that.
Well, Professor Dawisha, what do you think?
Well, I think that the if one looks at what the Kurds or the Iraqi Kurds are demanding now, they're not demanding separation. I have not seen a single declaration by one Kurdish official, say, over the last 7 or 8 years, since the mid-1990s, that speaks of separation or of a national homeland. But what they have been demanding is autonomy. Now, if you're asking me what do Kurds really want, you know, from the depth of their hearts, yes, probably they do want a state of their own. And historically, as you quite rightly said, there were some moves for that. But at the moment, they are faced with a geostrategic reality by which they know that this is an impossibility. It's not only the Iraqis, but the Turks, but the Iranians and the Syrians simply will not allow that. And then the speaker talks about we will never rest because of this problem. Well, believe me, if you give the Kurds a state, then the problems in the surrounding areas will be such that it will be absolute chaos. And interestingly, the Kurds themselves know that and accept that and have come to recognize that. So I agree with his last with the last part of his call, that if you give true autonomy to the Kurds, true autonomy, not the kind of autonomy that it was given to them by Saddam Hussein. But if you really make the Kurds autonomous, allow them cultural and political kind of autonomy, they can teach their language, education. And also, if you divert economic resources to the north, which they legitimately should have, and if you have a kind of a cooperation between the center and the Kurdish region or regions, I think the Kurds will be satisfied with that, and indeed it will be an excellent result of any post-Saddam political rearrangement of the country.
John, thanks very much. Good question.
Yeah, there's one other thing.
I'm afraid we've got to move on, John.
All right.
Appreciate the call. And Professor Dawisha, we thank you very much for your time as well.
Thank you for inviting me.
Adid Dawisha is the author of Arab Nationalism in the 20th Century, From Triumph to Despair, a professor of political science at Miami University in Ohio.